Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. In this series, we're going to meet and talk with experts in prevention and wellness, equity, health across the life course, and access to quality health care. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
Good afternoon, and I hope everybody enjoyed the morning. Your heads are spinning and thinking about the tough and important and ever increasingly important work of coalition building. And on behalf of the Board of Grantmakers in Health, its President and CEO Faith Mitchell, and the staff, I'd like to welcome you to the third annual Lauren LeRoy Health Policy Lecture. I'm Dr. Jandell Allen Davis, a Vice President of Government, External Relations and Research at Kaiser Permanente, Colorado, and Vice Chair of the GIH Board. Grantmakers in Health established the Lauren LeRoy Policy Lecture Series in honor of its former President and CEO, Lauren LeRoy. And I'd like to take this moment to go off script. I promise there won't be many of those. To acknowledge that Lauren's here today. If you'd stand up and let us acknowledge you. Sure, there are, Lauren, bunches of old friends and new in the audience to be made, so we're super happy you're here. And in addition to honoring Lauren just because she was the former president and CEO of Grantmakers in Health, you also had a strong commitment to increasing communication between the worlds of philanthropy and policy. So this series is supported by grants from Blue Shield of California Foundation, the California Endowment, the California Healthcare Foundation, the California Wellness Foundation, the Colorado Health Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, the Missouri Foundation for Health, the New York State Health Foundation, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Let's acknowledge those organizations as well. Thank you for this amazing show of support. So Manuel Pastor is a professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity at the University of Southern California. Dr. Pastor currently directs the Program for Environmental and Regional Equity at USC and USC's Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration. Dr. Pastor is an inspiring speaker, author, and teacher whose research explores the nexus of demographics, economics, and social justice. His work focuses on the myriad of issues facing low-income urban communities, as well as the change movements that seek to empower those communities and advance social equity. With that, please help me welcome Dr. Pastor to the podium.
Good to be with you. I was asked, and this is actually not the title that I had proposed originally, because the world changed. And some of you may know that the title, No Longer at Ease, is actually from a novel by Chinua Achebe, a Nigerian author, about a movement of a young man from the countryside to the city, the urban area, the dislocation he goes through. He is no longer at ease. And certainly that seems to describe a little bit about where the country is right now. And so I was asked by Faith and Ursula to speak last week. This was before the election. I said, could you kind of talk about demographic change in the country? And can you talk about grassroots mobilization? And can you talk about the role of funders? And can you do all that without being too political? And then last week happened, right? And then I was asked, could I also talk about the Iran nuclear deal and would it persist? And the next administration, is Steve Bannon going to give new meaning to the word White House? So, come on. So what I do want to do is to talk a little bit about some of the fault lines that just got exposed in the country, and then talk a little bit about work we've been doing on social movements. And I want you, as you think about social movements, to realize that many of you have your favorite social movement, right? But there are social movements that are not your favorites too, right? The evangelical Christian movement, conservative, is a very effective social movement in so many ways. There are many other movements that may not be your favorite, but they're legitimate social movements. But the seed I want to plant is that what's a little bit dangerous right now is that we're not actually looking at a social movement. Because as much as the anger is motivated in a way that has the sort of appearance of movement and has been talked about as a movement, it doesn't have the same coherence that movements have tended to have in the past. Hope to make that point. Then I'm going to tell you 6 things that funders should not do as you go forward, and then a couple of things that you might. So let me get started. I always like to let people know before I get started, some of you have seen this before, that while I'm talking, my voice might break or tire out. It's not that I'm emotional being with Grantmakers in Health, although what could be better for anyone's mood? It's that health folks will appreciate this. I actually have a speech disorder called spasmodic dysphonia. It's what Diane Rehm on NPR has. Bobby Kennedy Jr. has it, now me. It gets treated, this is true, once a month with Botox, because that's how we treat everything in Los Angeles. So Ron Brownstein, who's a commentator on CNN, and he writes a lot for Atlantic and has gotten to be a good friend over the last couple of years, has a riff on the cleavages that I want to kind of alter a little bit. That what you've seen is a kind of tension between a coalition of the ascendant, that means ascended demographically, which Ron talks about quite a bit, but also ascendant economically. That is, people who've been doing pretty well, people who are on the coasts, right, have benefited from metropolitan economies. And a coalition of the despondent, Americans, particularly white Americans, that feel that their country is slipping away on them, who feel that their jobs have slipped away, and that there must be some way to bring them back. And there's despondence about that loss. And it has a couple of different dimensions to it. First, of course, is the changing demographics. Faith and I actually met on a project in 1998 called Becoming America, which is about demographic change, right? Well, America became, and some people just don't like it, right? And America is continuing to change. It's projected by the year 2043 that the United States will be so-called majority-minority, or majority people of color. 10 years before that, the majority of the workforce will be people of color. For the last 2 years, the majority of kids coming into kindergarten have been kids of color. And if you'd been listening to the election season, now we all know that elections are a uniquely fact-free time in America for all sides, but if you'd been listening to the election, you would have thought that what was driving that demographic change was immigration. And of course, that's no longer true. Immigration in the country is stabilized and fallen. The immigration from Asia is now outpacing immigration from Latin America. Net migration from Mexico is actually negative, mostly because of lower fertility rates in Mexico. There are now more Mexicans returning to Mexico than are coming into the United States, which means that if we build a wall, we're just penning Mexicans in. I'm not sure that's the strategy. So what is really driving this demographic change, which means that it's sort of going to continue to happen, is the change in the youth population. So in the aughts, the number of young whites in the United States actually fell by 4.3 million. That's because of more young people moving into 19 and 20 than moving into 1 and 2. Where the growth was really coming was in the Latino youth population and the Asian Pacific Islander population. So what this means is that this demographic change is going to continue to occur. It's created discomfort. I'm going to make 2 points about that. One is the following. Here's one thing you know. 10 years from now, you're going to be 10 years older. That's that too, right? Those people will be 10 years older as well. The demography will continue to change. Second thing that's really interesting to realize is that where the demographic change is causing the most anxiety in the country is where the demographic change is not really occurring. So if you look at the Midwest, demographic change is really very slow there. And in fact, the refugees that have come in have helped to revitalize. And you've got places like Dayton, Ohio, trying to attract immigrants and refugees to revitalize their areas. If you look at the places that have had a lot of demographic change, with exceptions of places like Arizona, which had a very rapid spin up and a very snowbird older generation, places like California are like, okay, it's fine. We got to the end of this process, it ain't that bad, right? The anxiety about demographic change is where the demographic change is not occurring. So that's a really interesting phenomenon to take note of. The other phenomena has been, of course, the economic inequality. The economic inequality is coupled with economic uncertainty in a way that I'll describe in just a minute. But you can see the blue line here is the share of income going to the top 1%. It's from 1917 to 2015. You can see that basically since the 1980s, the 1% have been running away from the rest. And of course, that's helped trigger both the Bernie Sanders phenomena and the Donald Trump phenomena, the anger about the 1%. But perhaps even more fundamental is that below that 1%, there's actually also been pretty significant change amongst wage earners. These are people who are full-time year-round workers. In this case, we're looking at California compared to the U.S. The U.S. is gray. And you can see here that between 1980 and 2010, people at the 90th percentile of the full-time year-round workers, their wages went up. People in the middle, their wages went down. People at the bottom, their wages went way down. Easiest way to remember this, I'm a professor. I make a lot more money than professors ever made. My dad was a janitor. If he was alive, he would make a lot less money than janitors ever made. Because the economy, even for those below the 1%, has very high rewards for education and skill. People who can deal with globalization, who can deal with technology, et cetera. People who are not part of that are being left behind in the labor market. Even if Occupy got their way, it wouldn't change what's going on in these labor markets with the disappearance of the middle-wage jobs. That's causing a tremendous amount of anxiety. The other thing that's causing anxiety is uncertainty about the future. And the best way to think about this, in my view, is the following. How many of you take Uber? Of course, you know that what Uber is actively doing is destroying the traditional taxi cab industry. Here's what's fascinating about Uber. They hope that within 5 to 8 years, they're going to be running driverless cars. So everybody who just came to work for Uber is helping to destroy their employment. Now, that pace of change is incredible. My son is a musician whose backup career is as an actor. It's a hyper-successful economic strategy. And he has a girlfriend right now. He's always had very good girlfriends, but this one was about 3 years younger than him when he was 26. He said to me one day, we were sitting around talking, he goes, Dad, she's of an entirely different generation. I was like, his name is Joaquin. Joaquin, that's 3 years. How can that be? And he said, well, she just expects that she's never going to have a job because she came of age in the Great Recession. That's when she hit the labor market. So the uncertainty that's felt by the steelworker and the coal miner who feel like their jobs are disappearing, it's also felt by the millennials who don't know what their path is through this. So you've got this stew of racial demographic change, which causes for some people racial anxiety. For others of us, we're like, oh my gosh, you know, Korean taco trucks, yay. You know, that this is going to be a delightful mix and mashup of different experiences. You've got economic uncertainty, which for people who have got skills feels like, I'm going to clean up during the Trump administration, right? They're going to cut my taxes. I'm going to be able to afford the fact that they're kicking my kid off Obamacare. So you've got this tremendous uncertainty and unequal rewards. And then you've got a tremendous amount of growing social distance. And that growing social distance takes a couple of different forms. One is, in fact, residential segregation by race has declined slightly in our metropolitan areas over the last 30 years. Residential segregation by income has been on a constant rise. So we are more likely to live with people of our own class than we've ever lived before. And what that means is more distance. Similarly, children have very different experiences. This is how many kids of different ethnic groups are concentrated in high poverty schools. You can see that nationwide, it's about 11% of white kids are in high poverty schools, more than 75% of the kids on free and reduced lunch, where that's half of African-American kids and half of Latino kids. That's dangerous for productivity in the future, but it's also a particular kind of social distance. Final aspect of social distance, which I think is important, I'm 60 years old. Most of you are younger, which really ails me now. But one of the things that's interesting is when I was growing up, there were 3 television stations that we got our news from, right? And they were called broadcast news. We now have narrowcast news, where what you do is just listen to your own Twitter feed, right? And get the reinforcement that Donald Trump could not possibly win, right? Or the reinforcement that Hillary Clinton was about to be arrested by James Comey, right? So we live in this kind of narrow-casted social distance, and it's created a kind of epistemic or knowledge distance as well, where people are incredibly separate from one another. So what does that mean then for funders trying to make change? So funders have traditionally often operated on sort of Dewey demonstration projects, showing how things could work if you did something different. In the last bunch of years, there's been much more attention to policy. How do we change policies to make what we learn from projects be standard operating procedure? But there's also been a whole set of foundations experimenting with how do you change power, really, so that you can get these policies changed in place. And some of that has meant a lot more experimentation with investment, not just in advocacy organizations, which tend to be very grass tops, but also into organizing groups, which tend to be very grassroots. And so what that gets us to then is a discussion of social movements. And I want to take a little time talking about our research about social movements. So we actually sort of stumbled into this a little bit by accident. I had this research center, the Program for Environmental and Regional Equity. We've done a lot of work, and I've personally done a lot of work over about the last 25 years with movement organizations on campaigns around improving the environment in low-income communities of color, in campaigns to improve wages, in various campaigns to help with immigrant integration. And we got asked by funders, well, you work so much with social movements. Have you ever really turned your prism to say, how do social movements work? How can you support them? And how can they make change? And we thought, well, that's an interesting question. And we began to research that. And I'm going to define social movements. We did as sustained groupings. You'll see the elements of this in a second, that have a frame or a narrative based on shared values, that have a base, and that they're about transformations and systems of power. So we've done a lot of work on this, and I'm just going to quickly jump over. We started with this report called Making Change, How Social Movements Work and How to Support Them, The Color of Change on Interethnic Youth Organizing, Alliance Building called Connected at the Crossroads, a thing on Integrated Voter Engagement, which is community organizing coupled with GOTV, Moments, Movements, and Momentum. We've done some stuff on measurement that I'll talk a little bit about. And then we just last year released a book called Equity, Growth, and Community, which I highly recommend you buy. It's a great book. It's pretty much a literal page turner. If you don't want to buy it, actually, it's literally free as a download from UC Press because they're trying to a new model of how to get research out there. Although you probably do want to have the cover because it just feels right. I always like to let people know that if you're not a big reader, it's about to be made into a major motion picture. One of the reasons why I had to take the red eye here was that I was just finishing negotiating the movie rights yesterday in Hollywood. I'm going to be portrayed by Antonio Banderas, so I'm just really excited about it. And we also have a new project called Changing States. It's a website called changingstates.org, which says that people really ought to focus in on changing states at a very local level. And that if you wanted to do that, you would ask the question, what are the conditions for change? What are the capacities for change? What are the arenas for change? And you would have a 50-state strategy rather than a national flyover strategy. Maybe that sounds like a good idea in retrospect. So I want to tell you a little bit about the work we've done. So I'll say two things quickly. What we found is the following. And I've got to admit this as an academic. I don't know how many of you, the rest of you are academics. I know some of you have PhDs. The academic research on social movements is not particularly useful. It tends to sort of have a lot of theory. It tends to not necessarily be connected to the movements as they're occurring. And what we've found is that the best way to research social movements is to hang out with people who are organizers, to share your ideas with them midway, to present the reports with them to provide feedback on, and then when you present the reports, to have them be there with you, validating and asking the right kind of questions of where to go. So what we figured out was that rather than going through all the different social movement theories, which actually have not a tremendous amount of resonance, it's better to understand that there's basically 10 elements of social movements to keep in mind. And the discipline we had when we were doing this, and I want you to have this in your head too, is we wanted to make sure that we were describing not just movements we like the Dreamers. I mean, I like the Dreamers, right? Great group of kids, right? But the evangelical right that helped to seize control of the Republican Party, it's a very legitimate social movement. So as I go through this, you can hear elements from the right and from the left. Then I'll talk a little bit about why I think the Trump phenomena, because it's detached from this, might be something really dangerous in some ways, in a unique kind of way. So what are the elements? The first element, I think, of movement building is that movements basically have a vision and a frame. Van Jones, who's gotten quite famous recently, once reminded us that Martin Luther King, when he marched on Washington, did not give a famous speech called, "I have an issue." Rather, it's, "I have a dream." So movements tend to frame things in a very big vision, and that frame helps to set the terms of the debate and dictate what the policies might be. Second thing is that movements are not Twitter followers. They actually have a base and authentic constituencies that are organized on the ground. That's the reason why you can look at the Dreamers movement, which had a great vision and frame, basically taking on the American dream and calling it their own, right? And imagine, I mean, that was a ragtag group of undocumented kids who had no right at all to participate in the American political process, who seized the imagination of a nation and forced the president to implement DACA pretty much against his will, at least at the time. They had an authentic base in key constituencies, and so did the evangelical right as they organized in churches and moved forward to take significant share of the Republican Party. Just ask yourself, is a Make America Great a vision? And how organized is that constituency versus being organized in a set of churches or sets of immigrant communities? There's a lot of disgruntlement, but the authentic base. I mean, there's a base there. There's real people and real resentments. But whether it's organized in the same way you think about movements, it's very interesting to think about. Movements tend to be not episodic, but they're in it for the long haul. So, for example, the people who want to eliminate the travel ban and the embargo on Cuba. That's a group of folks who just want a vacation there. Agricultural interests that want to sell goods there. Car collectors who want to buy cars there. Tired old lefties who want to go someplace and see Jake about his poster blown up, right? And full size, right? That is not a coalition that's going to last past that issue, right? Coalitions are episodic and single issue. Movements tend to be in it for the long haul, around immigrant rights, around LGBT equality, right? Around bringing a sense of morality back to the public square, which is what a lot of what the right wing was about and about being pro-life, et cetera. They're in it for the long haul. Fourth big element for movements is they tend to have an economic strategy attached to them. And the economic strategy, because movements are often about redistributing resources, so you need to kind of demonstrate that you're not about to sort of kill the golden goose. Here, I think, is something that's really interesting, where you've got, on the one hand, a lot of the conservative groups, particularly in the 80s, grabbed a lot of the nation's attention, had a notion of limited government, let the private market decide a lot of things. That was the economic model. Whether it worked or not, debatable, but that was sort of the model. Part of what did happen in this election, and when you think about it, for someone who's got economic problems, saying, we're going to stop trade and we're going to stop immigrants, even if the evidence is that immigrants don't take jobs and that it's going to be hard to kind of walk back the trade thing, that's an economic strategy as compared to what was being proposed by the other side, which was really no economic strategy at all, if you're honest. So an economic model, really having an underlying economic model, the civil rights movement in part was about all this economic productivity would unleash by ending American apartheid. A vision of government and governance, how you can relate to the state. One thing that's been interesting, I think, for a lot of movements recently has been a scaffold of solid research, and that's a lot of what many of you who are grantmakers in health, by investing in the social determinants of health framework, you've invested in a scaffold of research that people can then use to push for getting parks in their neighborhood or healthier food or getting rid of environmental hazards, right? because the social determinants of health framework is something that you helped to invest in a scaffold of solid research. The right-wing conservatives of the 80s and 90s invested in the long haul, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, right? Creating a scaffold of solid research, right? The LGBT movement around marriage equality had a solid bunch of research supporting what its case would be. Donald Trump has one economist, Peter Navarro from UC Irvine. It's a phenomena detached from the usual elements of movements, which makes it more individual, more authoritarian, and riskier than if it was a Reagan embedded in a social movement with a real and authentic base and lots of other infrastructure around it. Pragmatic policy package. Movements these days do a lot of making sure that they've got stuff that will actually address issues. The other thing I think that is really key about movements, and this is important, the problems that movements are tackling are big. And what I try to say about this is particularly for funders, some funders say just, you know, I really want to invest in smaller groups because they're more authentic and grassroots. And sometimes that's true, but sometimes smaller groups are just small. So what you need to figure out is what's authentic and an anchor. What's real, has grassroots resonance, has real constituencies, but is actually sizable enough to do something. Some of you who are not in California, if you're liberal, I don't presume it, might have been looking at California and wondering, wow, I wonder when CalExit is coming. Because while the United States went in one particular direction, we passed a millionaire's tax, we reinstituted bilingual education, we actually put one more dent in the over-incarceration problem, and we decided to invest in Los Angeles in a permanent sales tax for mass transit. Why did that happen? In part because there's a pretty gigantic anchor organization called California Calls that mobilizes 750,000 voters. Almost last election is shooting for 1 million. In the next, new and occasional voters, mostly folks of color, not just low-income folks, lots of more sort of suburban and aspiring kind of working class folks. It's not the most desperate, it's the people who've been the least engaged, but who can actually swing elections. That's happened because of an anchor organization that's of sufficient size. So the need for scale. There's also a need for understanding scaling up and geography. One of the reasons why I was pointing you to that States of Change site is because I think that it's really important to understand if you want to make change, how do you make it in certain cities, bubble it up to metropolitan areas, bubble it up to states? It's hard to do. The other thing that's really true about movements that are successful are their willingness to work with other movements and stream together. The right, at least until this most recent formation, brought together people who were libertarian, people who were really church-based, people who were in the business community, sort of streamed together a lot of different things into the Republican consensus that was reflected at a party level by Reagan and by W. Bush. When you look at the way in which the Dreamer movement borrowed the trope of coming out from the LGBT movement, the way in which the immigrant rights movement staged freedom rides to connect themselves with the legacy of the civil rights movement, movements stream together when they're successful. And this actually has a really important impact on how you evaluate. And I'll get to that next. One of my favorite quotes here, and I think it's from Albert Einstein, but I have the suspicion that almost everything smart people attribute to Albert Einstein, but it's that not everything that counts can be counted and not everything that can be counted counts. And what we tend to do in the evaluation realm is we tend to count transactions and not transformations. We tend to count how many people come to a demonstration and not whether or not they become transformed to become leaders. We tend to count how many hits there are in newspapers rather than whether or not people have adopted the story themselves and they can tell the story to others. We've tended to focus on transactions, not on transformations. And the newest move in terms of thinking about sort of the metrics of movement building is to think about transformations. 6 warnings to funders who are interested in this, and then the conclusion. We have a tendency in the United States to not be able to hold 2 ideas in our head at the same time. So we think that if there's sort of one way of movement building we think is successful, that's the way it's got to take place in every location, in every locale along the same strategy. That's not true. So whatever you learn about what's successful, take some lessons, but try to figure out what it really applies to the next situation and what really makes for success in a particular situation. I'll skip number two, but I want to say something about the number three here, because this is about evaluation and the really key distinction between what most of y'all probably do, which is organizational effectiveness and movement effectiveness. And the easiest way for me to think about that is the following. I'm really close friends with, close allies, with an organization in South Los Angeles called Community Coalition. Their former executive director and I lift weights, which means you have to be really friendly because they might drop something on you, right? So during his 8 years or so as the ED, there's only one favor he ever asked in which he said, you know, you've got to do this. You can't say no. And that favor was to do strategic planning with a sister organization in East Los Angeles called Inner City Struggle, because they didn't think they could lead a fight for educational equality just out of South LA, because it would be marked as coming from the Black community, and they needed their ally in East Los Angeles to be as strong and as strategic and on plan as they were. If you were to measure that in terms of organizational effectiveness, they took one important asset and gave it away. If you were to measure that in terms of movement effectiveness, they built an ecosystem of change. I mean, the old community organizing model was about empire building. Build your own community-based organization, claim a lot of credit, and get bigger. The new model needs to be about ecosystem building, and that means that our evaluation structures need to change as well to try to understand what the ripple effects of actions are into the ecosystem and take that into account when you're measuring what a success is. The other kind of warnings I would issue to funders is don't think you're the social movement, right? There is a tendency to do that, like you get very excited. You're not, nor am I, right? I'm the researcher who puts things in nice packages and figures out how it fits and does some testing, et cetera. We have many staff slogans. One of our staff slogans at my shop is, we don't change the world. We work with people who change the world. I think it keeps us in perspective, and sort of thinking how that worked for you is important too. Second thing, understand that your grantees will sometimes confront power and do things that might make you feel uncomfortable. If you're a trustee, you can put your hands over your ears now. But the fact is that if you're funding good grantees, they're going to be graceful as they make trouble. But they're likely to be making trouble and to make things a little bit uncomfortable because change often only happens in that particular way. I have lived in LA for a long time, and my first academic job was at Occidental College. While I was there, did a lot of community-based work with community organizers. Right after the Los Angeles civil unrest, all of us were running from meeting to meeting, thinking if we went to one more meeting, we would solve something. Have you ever done that? I mean, you might be doing that now, right? So, in the middle of one of those meetings, an activist leaned back and said, there's an immediate need to think long-term. And out of that, people decided that we needed to figure out what the right kind of organizing was that was multiracial, and that turned out to be multi-geographic regional. Needed to focus in on the working poor because people care more about the working poor than they do about just the poor, and you could use that to leverage other kind of policies. Came a lot of long-term things that moved a lot of agendas. So many of you have worked in the Affordable Care Act. There's urgency. So many of us have worked on immigration. It was horrific to come in the day after the election and find a third of my staff in tears because of their family members. I hadn't realized quite how many people I'd hired who had family members who were undocumented. That's just the way it rolls. There's going to be a lot of urgency out there, and yet there's also a need to think long-term. And in terms of thinking long-term, one of the things I think we're going to need is to understand that equity, as we move forward in our health strategies and everything else, needs to be baked in at the beginning, not sprinkled on at the end. As we do it, we need to connect across these chasms of knowledge. Too many of us, particularly in the health field, should have been noticing and paying attention to that huge decline in life expectancy for white males and the pain that's going on in the Midwest and figuring out how to make those connections and make that part of the equity movement as well. But the final thing I want to say is the following. Right after the election, the next day I flew to Philadelphia. to actually give a series of talks in the suburbs of Philadelphia. One of them had some young people there, and it was a kind of breakfast for a lot of the people who run something called the Coatesville Youth Initiative. And then they asked me if I would come the next morning and just speak to young people to be an inspirational speaker to a bunch of high schoolers. So there's a couple of things you realize when you do that. Number one, as you walk in, you really wish you were like an astronaut or like a hip-hop artist, right? Or like being Kendrick would be way cooler than being Manuel, right? So you also realize that when you're with young people, really what you ought to do is ask questions, right? So let me tell you a little bit about Coatesville. It's an inner ring suburb. It's undergone tremendous demographic change. Most of the young people are African-American and Latino. So this audience was about 250 kids that are part of the youth initiative, overwhelmingly Black and Latino. Some white kids in there too. Good group of adults, a lot of older white adults who are really making that generational connection, want to lift up the next generation. But this is like a Compton in transition or in Inglewood, places where it's those inner ring suburbs that have experienced a lot of demographic change. And I asked this group of young people, because this conference was called Breakthrough Leaders, how they could be breakthrough leaders. I told them that sometimes you need to be a breakthrough leader when things break down, and that's a little bit of the world that they're facing. But then I asked them, well, what do you think makes for a leader? And the answers I got were amazing. Immediately, somebody said honesty. Someone else said reliability. Someone else said responsibility. Someone else said listening. Someone else said teamwork. Someone else said flexibility. And three things went through my head. Number one, all the values they named are not necessarily being modeled right now at the highest level, particularly in this election. The second thing I realized was those young people, African American, Latino, that's who everybody's scared of. And the values that they're holding dear, they're straight out of middle America. They're completely aspirational. They're completely about themselves taking responsibility for their lives. They're completely inspirational. And so the third thing I realized is that there's some challenges ahead. But America, we're going to be all right. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.